So this is the Singapore MIT Gambit Game Lab podcast, and it's here we have Austin Grossman, who's our guest.
Hello.
And we're here to talk to him and a few of his colleagues also from the Days in Looking Glass who work in our lab. So I guess we may be getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. I mean, I don't know from a podcast point of view if it makes sense to do sort of a short intros, or we start with Austin.
All right. I'm Austin Grossman. I started in the game industry at Looking Glass in the sort of late spring of 1992. Ultima Underworld 1 had just shipped, so we were starting Underworld 2, and ironically, what would become Terra Nova was in pre-production, but it didn't ship until like 8 years later. So that was my first game job, and I was at Looking Glass on and off for a couple of years through Shock and Flight and even bits of Terra Nova. And then I was off and I later did work on Trespasser, Clive Barker's Undying, Deus Ex, Tomb Raider Legend, bits of Deus Ex 2 and Thief 3, small bits, and heck, who knows else? What else? I was working on the Junction Points Mickey Mouse project this year. And more things which I can't even recollect at this point. I wrote a novel called Soon I'll Be Invincible. And I consult on video games now. I'm probably never going to stop working on video games.
My name is Andrew Grant. I actually got to Looking Glass towards the end of Austin's first sojourn there, early in 94, I think. I didn't actually get to work much on System Shock, but I was there watching them finish their crunch as I was working on Flight Unlimited. I was hired ostensibly as a designer and a programmer, and so while we were doing some programming on Flight Unlimited, Austin and I did a little bit of talking for a sequel to System Shock, which never really bore fruit. After that, I worked on a couple little projects at Looking Glass that mostly didn't get published, and then went to DreamWorks and worked on Trespasser as well with Austin. Since then, I've done mostly consulting work, and now I'm the technical director at Gambit.
I'm Sarah Varelli. I joined Looking Glass as System Shock was entering its first phase of testing as its lead tester, both writing the testing database and directing the testing that was going on at the Looking Glass site. There was another lead tester down at Origins who ran the team testing down there, so we had a lot of communication back and forth. I was at Looking Glass pretty much from then on till it closed. I worked on Terra Nova, I worked on Flight, I worked on British Championship Open Golf, which no one has ever heard of for good reasons.
I was going to say, I'd have never heard of it.
You know, it's okay that you've never heard of it. I wish I hadn't. I worked as a designer on Thief 1 and Thief 2 and led the production of the Thief Gold team and was looking at running the Thief Gold 2 team had Looking Glass actually made that product, which it didn't. I then went and worked at Irrational for a while, was their QA manager on a title that never shipped.
The Lost?
Yeah.
And aptly named.
Then served as the producer for SWAT. Oh dear.
I've SWAT
lost
4.
Track of numbers. Lost SWAT 4, yes. SWAT 4. And then took some time off and I'm now back here at Gambit working here.
It's eerie that you knew SWAT 4 and Sarah couldn't remember.
We just called it SWAT. We didn't call it SWAT N. It was SWAT.
Well, because you had only because you hadn't done the
we
previous
one. We didn't.
Ones,
yeah, we
right?
just did that
you were
one.
Doing the sequel
and so
and other
it,
had
the
done
number
the
the number one. And it wasn't important. What was important was it was the SWAT game.
It was the only SWAT game you did.
Yeah, so, it was the only SWAT game we did.
Okay. And I'm Matthew Weiss. As I said before, I'm the Looking Glass fanboy. So I'll be exploiting that. I've had this discussion with Sarah about like saying, oh, no, System Shock is so great, it's one of the greatest games ever, and you're like, no, but the usability is so bad and the UI is so bad and oh god, nobody can play it, oh my goodness, and I'm just like, oh my god, yeah, okay, sure, but it was the greatest game ever still,
right? Come on, we had that great help screen that flashes up at the beginning
and keeps you from seeing anything on the screen while it's up.
Really the most intimidating possible thing.
It was terrifying.
It's like pulling teeth to get it in there too.
It was everything. It was very helpful. I actually, just to give you a story, I got that game as part of a triple pack, the Origin triple pack. It had System Shock, Bioforge, and Wing Commander 3. And I love Bioforge. I really like Bioforge. But anyway, I played Bioforge and Wing Commander 3, and I took one look at System Shock and saw that screen, and I didn't play it for 9 months.
That's what I mean by usability issues.
No, this is what you don't understand. 9 months later, I had one of my greatest gaming experiences ever. Right? So that's kind of how I remember the game.
But so much better if you had the greatest gaming experience right then instead of waiting nine months.
But as I look back sort of in the mists of history, that doesn't matter, right? I mean, maybe it matters for like everybody else.
Maybe it matters for the sales of the game.
It matters for the sales of the game, but not for how it enriched my life. So that's what we're talking about, right? You know, because you do these things. The game has some problems, but you know, I think it's worth recognizing if a game, you know, is worth the trouble for me. But anyway, considering that, so I would basically just like to ask some questions about that game and also several other games that you guys have worked on that Austin has worked on, and basically just you know, have a discussion about some of these things. Oh my God!
Sorry.
What is that voice saying?
All right, here we are. This is it's a litmus test.
So for the longest time I thought that voice was saying, "You're rebels from Rebelzoid." That's what I thought
we
it was
never
saying.
Came up with that one. The idea, of course, is that it's not supposed to say anything.
It's just like a gibberish kind of.
It's a gibberish, but there were two versions of what it said around the office. One was your memos are never good, which actually comes through quite clearly once you've heard that. And then there was something else. It's not a great sound clip. So there was something else that was equally valid, but I can't even remember it.
Your memos are never good. Okay, yeah, now I see it.
Did you not understand what we were talking about when we were talking about your memos?
I was
good?
Just
I'm
like,
curious.
What are you talking about? I know that sound, though.
Okay.
I
know
think
that
people
sound.
Outside Looking Glass ever caught on to that.
No, but I mean, I know that sound, though. Wow, crazy. Anyway, so what I'm interested in doing a bit is, I guess, going through one of the things, Austin, I did is I looked at your... Now, Moby Games is sort of not the best resource, but there's not a whole lot of places you can go to find out like what somebody did in their work. And one of the things that interests me a lot is, so I have a topic for this discussion that's I would call chasing authorship in video games, because for me, playing a lot of these games and really loving them a lot, I perceive a lot of what I would consider to be sort of authorial intent, where I think there may not be. So I would play a game and I'd be like, wow, this is genius, because this part of the game relates to this other part of the game, and obviously that was intentional and that's so awesome. And, you know, usually it's not quite the case, right? So games are more collaborative, usually they are a lot of the time. And I'm just wondering if we can go through some of the games and figure out exactly like what your role was in them and how you feel that relates to sort of like the overall experience that the game was generating. And was that something that you were conscious of? Was that something that you and other people were sort of consciously pushing for, et cetera, and stuff like that? So I was wondering if you could just start with Underworld 2. What was your role in that exactly?
Right. Yeah, that was the first game I worked on. I was hired just as Underworld 1 had shipped. I was hired mostly as a writer for that. The sort of overall storyline had already been set. So I was as much a dialogue writer / high concept level designer as anything else. And I wrote in the scripting language that we had for the conversations. That was really my apprenticeship, making video games.
Are there any particular sections of that game that you would consider yourself sort of primarily responsible for as sort of like a kind of a vision, like the guy who sort of Do you look at that game and see your personality in it, in particular parts of it at all, or in terms of the dialogue or sections of the game?
In particular parts of it. Because it was an Ultima game, you kind of had to adopt the Ultima style. I remember there were some conversations I had more fun with. Oh, God, because it was a game that was broken up into a whole series of different alternate dimensions, it's a little hard to remember all of them. I remember one where there was a kind of, that was kind of modeled on Tomb of Horrors. When there was a series of sort of undead liches, and that was the one I was proudest of, that I felt like I had the most voice in. It was in some way like a mini prototype for System Shock, because it was made up of dead people, and it was It was one of those games of excavating backstory as you explored a space.
Because you were exploring sort of like this dead, haunted space, but the hauntedness of the space was sort of the story, right?
That
you were
exactly, exactly. So it was a mini world that we had a lot of that we had fun with, and I remember it particularly because I felt like the writing was sort of taking off there, and there was stuff I took away from that for System Shock.
That's really interesting. Can you think of? I mean, can you think of any of those? Do you have any specific ideas in mind, or exactly? Like, can you give an example of something from that particular section of the game that you feel was taken and how it was actually put into System Shock?
Well, this was broad high concept. I remember, it has been so long since I played Underworld 2. There was a kind of series of tombs that you went through with a sort of series of undead people, liches, I guess, that you had to fight. I can't remember if the Ultima World has a different name for liches.
No, they're called liches.
So there are people, and they got harder and harder. And I think they were undead people of different character classes. So they had kind of different speeches. And it was one of the kind of anti Ultimas of the alternate worlds in which there were was a sort of king, and his sort of high level minions and. They each had a sort of different personality depending on their
and
class.
You could talk to them, too,
you could talk
right?
to them.
Or this game had dialogue where you could actually like...
Yeah, they would have their dialogue. It was a relatively linear setup. I had already kind of tweaked to the fact that branching dialogue was in some ways a lose for telling stories and getting an emotional effect. So I actually kept that to a minimum in that level and tried to sort of explore getting personality expressed in a way that broke the fiction less than doing branching conversations and handling contingencies that couldn't quite be handled effectively.
So that's really interesting. So when you say, so this game actually, for people who don't know, it had actually just a sort of a normal, typical RPG branching conversation system inherited from the mainstream Ultima games.
That's right.
Now you, as somebody who had some control over that, you dealt with that how? Did you design the conversation with less branches? Were the ghosts or the liches like less talkative, or like how did you imbue that personality using that same set of tools?
I'm trying to remember, and it's a bit dim in my memory. But the idea was that the Ultima Underworld 2 was a game with a hub, right? You would do a mission and you'd go back to the castle, and the hub was very complicated, and we tried to make it reactive to different things that you had done and have different storylines. And the problem was when you opened up the idea of that kind of freeform gameplay and many interacting personalities, it was something that the system ended up not being that great at. You would want to invoke the sense of people's presences, but like, once you kind of invited the idea that there were many personalities and who were sensitive to real actions in the world, you would always bump up against the limits of that. I mean, you could, someone would talk to you and they would react to what you've done. It was great, but then you could sort of pick up a fish and throw it in their face, and they would have no reaction.
And they would just be like, whatever. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, so what I was playing with there, and then later in System Shock, was the idea of sort of somewhat counterintuitively reducing the amount of contingency an NPC would have to handle. Trying to finesse the problem in game design by actually sort of closing down possibilities the player could explore, because those possibilities wouldn't be handled effectively.
But also minimizing the sort of cognitive dissonance you would get.
Exactly. It was working against that.
That's great. I mean, it's really interesting to hear you say that in a very specific way, talking about this particular level in Underworld, because in some of the research I did, just sort of looking for old interviews with people like Doug Church and mm-hmm. Warren Spector and stuff like that, Doug Church specifically mentioned the sort of everybody's dead in System Shock as a solution to the sort of dialogue frustrations in the two Underworld games. And before this podcast, you were saying earlier about Looking Glass being a place where people talked about design problems a lot and these different ideas, and it was intellectually rich in that way. And I'm wondering, so you talk about dealing with this problem yourself in this particular level and then in System Shock. So were you dealing with lots of other people who had the same sort of interest? Were you like saying, making this level and then talking to somebody that afternoon and you're like, oh yeah, no, I totally agree with you. This is a problem. So, and then like you all get together when you're having these initial System Shock meetings and then you're sort of deciding like, let's deal with that? Or how exactly did that come about?
I think I was probably more frustrated with the RPG elements of Underworld 2 than other people, but as a group we talked a lot I'm not even sure we use the word yet, but about player agency and sort of emergent effects in games, things that were unpredictable. And it was kind of clear that the range of things that could happen in the 3D game, interacting with the objects and the combat systems, was much more varied and different each time you played, versus when you went into the conversation system, suddenly you were playing a much simpler game and a much less interactive game. So that going into those conversations was kind of a drag, and you'd be spacebarring through text, and you would have fallen into a much more boring game, mm-hmm. or a boring mini game. What you'd really want to do is get out into the world and interact with that 3D space and you know, all that spell system and those objects that had different properties and the AIs such as they were.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The game, you know, the game would freeze when you were in conversation. So I think that was a palpable frustration that everybody had that I helped put a name to. And, you know, we were very, very interested in the medium and the technology that we had going, and sort of trying to sense the most fun thing about that technology was, I think, something we all did together.
Well, that sounds great. So when you were doing, sort of, you said you were there for the pre-planning of System Shock mostly.
Yes.
So I guess was there, one of the things that's interesting to me about System Shock is the extent to which it's very similar to Underworld, right? I mean, you sort of get rid of the numerical stats and stuff like that, but there's still all these sort of tools you find. To me, System Shock 1 is like Underworld on the first game specifically on a space station, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of going down levels, you're going sort of up levels on this space station. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the extent to which System Shock was kind of like a cyberpunk sort of reimagining of a lot of those same concepts. And did you ever consider having character dialogue in the game, or was that like always from the beginning, like, no, let's definitely not do it? Or was it originally more like Underworld? Was it less like Underworld? Like,
well, we knew we wanted to do something kind of cyberpunky. It was 1993, we knew we wanted to do something in space. We knew we wanted to get out of the kind of the crustiness of fantasy role playing. So that was one of the driving forces. Of course, there weren't really first-person shooters yet, except for, I guess, Wolfenstein was out around that time. So we didn't really quite think that we were making a first-person shooter. We were making a role-playing game with more action elements, and we had kind of caught on to the fact that guns and ranged weapons were much more interesting than melee.
Because there were bows in Underworld, though, I think.
Oh yeah, no, there were. Yeah. I mean, and ranged spells and so forth. Yeah. But anytime you did that, your brain clicked into the fact that you were kind of leveraging the idea that you were in a 3D space, and you could work with geometry. And everybody had put so much energy into making a display 3D geometry. And anytime that was useful in the gameplay, like it suddenly turned on a part of your brain that was kind of not less interested in the 3D space before. Of course, 3D was pretty new. Everyone was thinking about how to play in 3D space. And was 3D just going to ruin games? Because games were fun in 2D, but not 3D. We didn't know. Now I've lost track of the question.
I was just asking. About some of those pet peeves about Underworld and how that got redirected.
Right. I remember there was so much talk around Looking Glass that we actually tried to formalize it and actually had people kind of give talks about their thinking about games. I think the only one that was ever actually done was mine, and that was actually a big critique of Underworld 2 that I did. That was way late in Underworld 2.
So you got together and gave talks, kind
of
like.
Well, there was the idea that there would be a series of talks, and I don't think any other ones happened.
Was yours the first one?
I think my first and only.
And the last.
The first one.
I killed that idea. But that was when I brought out some of these ideas that
you stated earlier.
Yes. The inspiration for System Shock, part of it was actually a book called The Spoon River Anthology, which I don't know if you know it, but it's a book of poems basically from the point of view of various different inhabitants of a small town. Spoon River, and that reading it, you get a kind of overarching sense of the life of that town and various things that
happened. It's all epitaphs, right?
Yes. I think Warren Spector knew it. So I think I originally had the Spoon River anthology in my pitch for it. But that was the idea that for me concretized how System Shock could work, like a series of short speeches from people that, when put together, gave you the history of a place. And, you know, I mean, it's much rehearsed now, but the advantages of that, of course, were less freezing of the game, less breaking of the fiction, less having you interact with people who couldn't really interact like people, and it was kind of palpable once you met someone in an RPG that they couldn't react to things. There was a lot in System Shock that was reacting against.
Well, one thing that's interesting to me about the game, and this sort of goes back to the authorship idea, is so you're talking about this particular decision to have everybody dead and essentially mm-hmm. be, in sort of a science fiction sense, ghosts, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're in this place of ghosts, and you can sort of hear echoes of them, but you can't really interact with them.
Yes.
So that's one way to remove dissonance. But one of the things that struck me about System Shock when I played it that felt like there was some sort of mastermind behind the game mm-hmm. who was just kind of like, we're going to remove all possible dissonance. Like, everything in that, for me, that is like one of the most seamless games I've ever played, right? Not only do you not have to worry about not being able to interact with people, mm-hmm. like there's no cutscenes, loading only happens in the elevator, it never cuts, ever. The only, anytime you see a cutscene, it's actually a video mail. Like anytime you see outside right. the ship, it's actually so this little pod that's recording the station from the outside, and you get a V-mail sent to you and you see it, and the last one where the station explodes, you actually see the camera short out at the end of it and stuff like
right.
that.
And of course you had Showdown, who you couldn't talk back to, but who could react to games that events that could easily be sensed through the regular trap trigger system in the game. There was a lot of really good smoke and mirrors thinking that went into System Shock.
It was. I mean, for me, it was extremely phenomenal. And for me, lots of games that came after it did not do it nearly as well or as coherently, which is one of the reasons why it remains for me a really great game. But it's interesting that you mentioned Showdown there, because one of the things I really love about it is in a lot of games, the designer is always there implicitly as a force that's mm-hmm. sort of against you, right? I mean, you're sort of fighting the designer in a game, but the game sort of pretends like it's what's happening is natural or something. It's not. It's totally artificial. It's totally constructed. And I love this idea that Showdown is sort of like this metaphor for the game designer, right? You're really... So just like the fact that things happen that are totally unfair, that in any other game it would be like, oh, that's stupid. The game designer obviously just totally is fucking with me. In this game, that made the story stronger, not weaker.
Right. You're playing a game and you're like, oh, it feels like the game designer hates me. Well, Showdown does hate you.
and she has control over your entire space, right?
Yes.
And she's designed your entire space as a series of deliberately unfair, tricky sort of challenges.
Yeah. Some of it, I think, was probably lucked into the plotting, and just kind of got developed in a very, very happy way. Of course, at the same time, they were making Doom. I think probably one of the reasons System Shock doesn't have great immediate descendants is, of course, that everybody got so psyched about Doom when it came out around the same time. And in a way, Doom was a similar game in that it dispensed with a lot of the RPG conventions, and I think people liked it because they weren't burdened with a complicated story that they had to wade through. They had a very simple story that had a very kind of driving energy that pushed them through.
I mean, System Shock 1 is very complicated, especially, mm-hmm. like, I have a memory mm-hmm. actually of playing the game until 2 in the morning, mm-hmm. going to sleep, and then wake, and then sitting there in my bed trying to put together the timeline of when the entire story happened, and then getting up at 4 in the morning and then saying, God damn it, and then like listening to all the radio logs I had, writing down what the dates mm-hmm. of all of them were, figuring out who died when, and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, the game takes a lot of detective work that I feel like later games that borrowed those ideas didn't as much, right? Like, I don't think you have to do quite as much work in something like Bioshock to put that together. I mean, System Shock really just drops this entire world on you, and you really just have to deal with it. And I mean, do you see that as a flaw, or do you see that as something that was kind of, because to me it feels rich, but then again, I was
well, by many measures, and chime in here, System Shock is overcomplicated for a mainstream gamer. But then again, it's one of those games that can be played more simply, but rewards investment and thinking about the backstory. Other games, I remember Deus Ex was put together in a similar way, where there was a lot of material out there that you could investigate and learn about the world, but if you wanted to concentrate on shooting folks, you could. So it's a strength of System Shock, even though it was probably too intimidating for less invested players.
I kind of feel like at that time, there weren't a lot of games that gave you a whole lot of material that you could safely ignore. Right, that was something you expected. I mean, some of the text adventures perhaps, but even then, every object in text adventure was significant. You needed it to win the game. And this kind of, you know, not every object in Underworld was needed, but the things you didn't need were things like, you know, a random sword you found. But everything that wasn't a weapon, you probably needed.
Well, there also wasn't a lot of textual information in Underworld 1, right? It's kind of like you talk to people, but those conversations were sort of over. Every time you found a recording in System Shock, you were carrying it with you for the rest of the game. So you're generating this huge bag of sort of messy, incoherent character histories, which you actually have to spend the time to sort out if you want to.
Yeah, and in my play style at the time, I found it daunting. I was like, wow, there's a whole bunch of stuff here. I sure hope I don't need all that, but I must need all of it, or they wouldn't have written it.
It was extremely daunting, but I had nothing to do that Christmas when I was when I was playing it. And I was just like, man, I played all my other games. I guess I'll try System Shock again. And I swear to God, like, I couldn't put it down for like 48 hours. And it has this... one of the other things that's interesting about the game to me is that it sort of works its way towards this final section that gets sort of in, you know, lots of games sort of peter out near the end, but I feel like a lot of the people, to me, System Shock has like the last four or five sections of the game are just phenomenal. There's this whole part at the end that's like Apollo 13, where like everybody, it's like you're in space by yourself, and like everybody who designed Shodan is back on Earth saying, oh my God, she's going nuts, we got to try and stop her. And it's like you're on tech support with like all the people who designed her, and you're trying to figure out how to deal with her. So you keep getting these messages from all these people and stuff. And I just have like these really strong memories of that being a really cool part of the game and everything. And then I remember there's this part at the very end where you crawl up this huge long ladder to get, like, there's like this neck of the space station because you want to get to the bridge. And I always had this idea that was inspired by the Andromeda Strain. Like, that there's like this huge, because at the end of the Andromeda Strain, they're like climbing up this ladder.
I never saw it. I wasn't in on designing the end of System Shock. All honor goes to whoever was in charge of that.
So that's another interesting authorship question. So you were there in...
I was there early. I was there with a lot of basic plotting and the basic conceit of the audio logs and some of the level high concepting and interface high concepting and furring up a bunch of the goals. I wrote the original design document, but I was replaced pretty early into actual full production. I came back to do some of the writing, and of course some of the voice acting.
Do you remember what you did in the game?
I was Edward Diego. I was.
Oh my God! You're him. Oh my
the
God!
The lame executive. That
you're like the mini boss. You're like Odd Job.
I remember. Yeah, that was fun. Of course, it was one of those all office talent voice recording. I'm sure you guys were in it. Or
Sarah's face is in it.
Right? My face is in it, but not my actual voice. There weren't that many women's parts. So.
Oh, sad.
Oh my God! So you're the guy in the intro.
Yes.
Who's like who gives the hacker the sort of proposition?
The charges against you are severe.
Oh my God!
That's the line I remember.
But they could be dismissed. They could if be you dismissed. Perform a service.
That's right. That was exactly the word.
There may be a neural, military grade neural interface for you if you get the job done right.
Don't make me beg you to stop. Yeah, that's what happened. But didn't it shipped in two versions, right? There was the floppy disk version that didn't have the audio, right? And there was the CD version?
The floppy disk version
had no audio,
and then the CD-ROM version shipped.
Wait, had no audio or had no voice?
It had no audio, it had no voice, it had the music and sound effects. But everything was text, and then the CD-ROM.
One of the many things that led to System Shock not selling that many units was that was sort of straddling the line, I guess, between floppy and
CD-ROM. I never played the floppy version. Like, I was only familiar with the CD version.
And the floppy version was like 10, it was either 8 or 10 discs. It was...
And that was brutal, because the chances of a disc being bad or the chance of
an
installer being bad...
But it was right at the end of that cycle when games were on discs and on lots of discs.
Right, exactly,
Not only the high-end computers had the CD-ROM players, so... you couldn't just release on CD.
High-end computers like the 486s?
Yeah.
Or like the Pentium 1.
Those were so fast.
I remember I played that game. I think I played it like a year after it came out because it was in that sort of like triple pack thing that I was saying. But I remember I got it. I bought a computer for Wing Commander 3, and that's the computer I played it on, so it was fine.
But it was one of those tangible moments when a leap in technology changed the feel of a game completely.
I did have one more question for you about System Shock. So if you were writing the original... sort of the original conceit of the whole story and everything about this hacker who's sort of hired to basically tamper with this AI, and it's the result of the hacker's behavior that actually makes the AI become sentient. And then, so there's this whole, I mean, this is like, I guess, more literary, I guess, but one of the things I also like about the game is that this is a really strong theme of sort of like, who is birthing who in the game. It's kind of like, Shodan is sort of like, something you created, but also she has sort of like this, like, no, but I'm your creator, or I'm your dominator, kind of a thing like that. And that's like a, was that like intentional or like?
There were so many versions of the plot that were worked through that I can't remember exactly how that idea entered into it. We certainly were, again, sort of sick of the Avatar in the Ultimate games. We didn't we wanted to have somebody that was interestingly morally compromised or involved in their situation. But I don't remember how that specific detail came up. I do remember also pitching the protagonist as a woman. And this was pre Lara Croft, obviously. And people looked at me as if my head had fallen off. A woman? Starring in a video game?
But you never see yourself anyway in the game, though, right?
No, you don't.
You see yourself in the cinematics.
Yes.
But that's interesting. So you had nothing to do with the sort of the... How did you envision in the original version the ending, like when you actually go mano a mano with Shodan at the very end?
I think that... I can't remember how that came out, but I imagine it came in somewhat
that actually got
later.
Developed really towards the end.
Yeah.
It wasn't in for the longest time, and it was one of those things that as... I would claim as beta approached, but that would be a lie... much closer as ship approached, there was this, you know, we really kind of need a final battle now.
I always think that it does reach back a little bit to the kind of surreal interdimensional void of the end of Underworld 1. I think everybody remembered that as an ending they like, and that there was some component of thinking back to that.
Well, it's interesting because one of my biggest annoyances being a fan of the first game is that anytime you mention the game, everybody's only played the second game. And in the second game, you kill Shodan by putting a shotgun in her face and blowing her up, which I don't find nearly as interesting as the ending of the first game, where you really sort of do this thing where, like, your brain sort of connects with her brain and your brain sort of fight, and that's expressed in this, like, really weird sort of abstract kind of world of cyberspace. And I remember the game has this thing that happens at the very end, which if you weren't there when it was being developed, I'm sure you probably had nothing to do with it, but it was one of the really fascinating things about the game, where at the end of the game, you're fighting Shodan, which of course doesn't look like a face in the computer, because that's not what she looks like, right? That's her avatar that she shows on screens. But she looks like a cone. It's like she's like a cone with like claws on the top or something like that.
She's a simplified representation like the rest of Cyber.
Which to me sort of reminded me of like the master control program in Tron, right? This like giant cylinders.
Or Neuromancer. Remember, the AI manifests as a white cube in Neuromancer, which I know everybody read a lot of times.
So I think at the very end, your screen sort of starts, the pixels start disappearing on your screen when you're fighting her, and at the end it's like her face sort of just covers your computer screen.
I don't even remember.
And do you not remember that? Because like this like is the final thing about the game like totally blew me away. Like I mean, you can interpret this any way you want. The way I read that is that I sort of opened my brain up to Shodan, and she got inside my brain and erased it, right? So it's kind of like, because at the end of the game, it's almost like a fourth wall breaking kind of thing, like at the very end of the game. And the game boots you out of the game at that point. It doesn't give you the game over screen, which I found really interesting.
Not that many narrative video games have interesting endings. This is a notable truth.
Oh, I would agree. Anyway, I just wanted to give a shout out to this one, because I think it was pretty phenomenal, and I guess not a lot of people actually made it to the end. That's really cool. That's great. I wonder if there's a few other. I don't know if it makes sense to go through a few more games. I mean, I know that you worked on a lot of stuff, but I know some of the other notable ones. Notable for me, I guess. Notable for Drew is Trespasser, and I'm wondering if we could talk about that a little bit, or if you'd be willing.
I have no problem talking about
to
that.
Talk about that. Okay. So, I guess for people who don't know, so after you left Looking Glass, how did the DreamWorks thing actually come about? So,
well, DreamWorks was starting up its studio right about, I think, 1995 or so. I mean, it was a big deal because they were starting a new music studio and a film studio at the same time, and it had an interactive wing, which Microsoft owned half of. So it was a crazy big deal. And then Seamus Blackley was going out there, and it was kind of his idea that he made the connection out there. And he had just done Flight Unlimited and had done some physics programming for System Shock and Terra Nova. And he had the idea that we were going to go out there, and they were going to be... The idea was that it was going to be a creativity-driven place, and they would kind of give us all the rope we needed to hang ourselves. And that dream came true.
Well, just to give you a perspective, I first heard about, just as a gamer, like I first heard about Trespasser because as like the crazy game with the hand, and I remember reading about it and saying like, oh wow, they can't be that crazy, can it? And then I remember playing it, being really blown away. And then when Andrew came in to interview, did we mention it?
When
in the interview, and you were kind of like, oh my god, and we were like, no, it's really interesting. Like, we found it to be a very interesting experiment.
There were a great many good ideas that went into it. We were, I don't know how much we want to break this down.
Well, we don't necessarily need to. I guess what I'm interested in about the game is, how do you see the game fitting into that kind of design trajectory that you sort of talked about coming from, you know, the kind of like reducing of cognitive dissonance, right, coming from System Shock. And where does the game fit into that in terms of what we were trying to do versus what was created?
Right. Well, we did a great many of the same things we did in System Shock narratively. We had an island that was depopulated, that had left traces of the people who lived on it. This was going to be the island where the Lost World, the second film of Jurassic Park, Lost World, did a lot of messing with the Jurassic Park canon, which is something that no one cares about. But yeah, we did a lot of the same things. There were a lot of traces, and there were some a lot of writings left by different inhabitants. There was a central presence on the island, which was John Hammond, the guy who ran the company that had originally cloned the dinosaurs. So his history was encoded there. We did a lot of the same tricks. We did a new thing by having the protagonist, giving the protagonist a voice. As well, which is something we didn't do in System Shock.
I see you got your female protagonist in that game.
I did.
And also further, the UI went in the same direction as well. I mean, go from Underworld to System Shock, you see the UI is a little bit more seamless. It feels like more part of the world.
Yeah, there was
Trespasser. We did the same thing by removing the UI entirely.
Yeah, there was. There were many sort of purisms that happened in Trespasser, and one was no HUD. And like System Shock, we had targeting that was independent of your movement. That is to say, we didn't just have a targeting cursor locked at the center of the screen. You could target independently of movement.
It wasn't mouse look. You were actually moving. I mean, you were using the mouse, but you were moving a reticle.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did, I know that the Trespasser story is a long one in terms of how the game sort of ended up the way it is. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff you can say about what you were trying to do with the physics and all this kind of stuff. But one of the interesting things that Andrew has said in the past is that some of the interesting unrealized ideas is that it was very much more of like an open world kind of place, right? It's like, I'm just exploring this haunted island and there's dinosaurs, right? And I remember you said at one point that the dinosaur population has this kind of ecosystem aspect to it.
The AI was designed to have an ecosystem aspect to it, but it's unrealized because of the development problems. We never got to take advantage of that fact.
But you said it's basically just like commented out, or it's kind of just shut off, basically. But like, what was it supposed to do?
Well, theoretically, the dinosaurs were supposed to act kind of like animals rather than game adversaries. So you'd have your dinosaur, if a T-Rex maybe, and he'd wander around, and he'd be hungry, and maybe he wouldn't be hungry. And as time went on, he might get more hungry. And so if you were to, you know, waste too much time in an area, he might start thinking, well, you know what? You look kind of yummy. And so, or then if you could lead him off to another dinosaur, maybe he'd eat that instead because he thought it was less dangerous. If you shot him a couple times, he'd think, well, hey, I'll eat that brontosaur instead.
Yeah, we definitely want to reproduce, you know, some of the moments we liked in other video games. I mean, I thought it was always cool when monsters turned on one another, when there was this sense that you weren't the only interesting presence in the world, and that you could have some unpredictable effects out of monsters turning on one another. That was something that actually happened in Doom. If you could get creatures in Doom to shoot one another, they'd start to fight one another. And that was one of those cool things where you could manipulate the world in an interesting way, and you could make a cool plan that you could carry out that wasn't designer-driven. So that was one of the kinds of moments that we wanted to have happen in Trespasser as well. We innovated on many, many fronts, and we had many, many ideas that we stuffed into the thing, which was one of the big difficulties with making it work.
The game is sort of famous for a lot of its unrealized ideas and some of the awkwardness of the interface, and I'm wondering if there, like, how would you characterize, I mean, first of all, I don't know, do you agree with that, or like, how would you characterize how the game turned out?
Oh, I don't know. Well, it didn't really work out, did it?
That's its reputation. And I'm just wondering,
given some of the design ideals you were sort of talking about before, how do you sort of get from that? What do you feel sort of like the legacy, I guess, of the game is in that sense? Or what do you think the game sort of achieved? Did you feel like it achieved anything that other games sort of learned from? Maybe it came along later and sort of successfully did? Or
it did a lot of things that other games tried to do later. It was a shooter, but it was outdoors in a fairly open environment. It had a female protagonist. It worked, obviously, with... It combined physics gameplay with shooter gameplay, and when I actually went to hear, I guess, who is it, Jay Stelly talk about using physics in Half-Life 2, they had run into so many of the same problems we did that it was kind of uncanny. We kind of ran headlong into some of the problems that other people had with physics later. And even now, physics feels a little underutilized in 3D gaming because the design problems it poses are actually really, really hard, even when you have a very stable physics middleware like Havok.
Yeah. And it's not just physics. I mean, in a whole bunch of areas, the rendering outdoor scenes, I mean, it's easy to say, yes, we did FPS in an outdoor scene, but that was a gigantic rendering challenge.
Harking back to System Shock, we again straddled a big technological transition point, which was dedicated graphics cards.
Right.
We had an initial renderer written without those things, and we never quite adapted, if I understand it correctly.
So that was yet another
crossing a technology line in the course of development that kind of handicapped the final product.
So just to give a little bit of my own experience with the game, just as a player, each summer here when we have the students come and we talk about game design and they all make games, we have this night where we talk about UI and different sort of games with different UI issues, right? So we usually show Trespasser. And the first summer we were showing Trespasser, we actually had a really great experience showing the game to a bunch of kids. And it was one moment where I feel like a lot of the elements of the game actually sort of came together, or perhaps how they were intended. And I remember it was like I had a gun and I had dropped it, or there was a dinosaur. But it was interesting because it was like there was a room full of kids watching the game, and the audience response to the game was actually pretty phenomenal. Everybody was like, oh my God, pick up the gun. And you could actually, because the hand is so awkward, you really got this feeling of like, I'm reaching for it, but there's all these other things affecting my behavior and I'm really trying to aim it and everything like that. And at that moment, it didn't just feel like a game that didn't work. It felt like I was a clumsy human being who is like having this confrontation with this really powerful animal.
You could have, every once in a while, cool moments like that. The downloadable demo for Trespassers actually plays much better than the shipping game, because we did it after the shipping game.
Oh, really?
And we learned how to leverage some of those things. I mean, it had a great, great tech demo, which goes to show you that you when you have a technology and you leverage it properly and constrain it properly, you can do great things, which is something we didn't really manage to do in Trespasser.
Yeah,
if you hang around and just shoot raptors and see their cool skeletons deform and see them react, isolated moments are really great. It's one of those things that tricked us into thinking we had a great product.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing about Trespassers, that really its lows are really low, but its highs are really high. When things are just working and it's going quite well, it's remarkable. But you have to wait a long time and slog through a lot of not so great, really bad stuff before you can get to one of those moments.
I was at GDC a couple of years ago, I think during the rant, one of the rant sessions, and Chris Hecker, as he likes to do, brought up Trespasser, because he and Seamus have a back and forth thing. And Chris said the important thing about it, I guess, which was that, like, yeah, it was a mess, but they could have done a cookie cutter shooter at that point and banged it out, and no one would remember it. But like, they tried a bunch of different things that didn't work. And wouldn't you rather developers did that, by and large?
Well, if you're a buyer, perhaps. But if you're a corporate entity, perhaps not.
I've been spreading the word about Trespasser. There was a guy I talked to, and I was like, "Have you heard about this game?" And this was like this year, right? Or last year. He was like, "No, what is that?" And I'm like, I sort of described it to him, and he's like, "I got to see that. That sounds crazy, right?"
I still get email about it. I mean, we were also lucky in that I think probably 6 months after it came out, Daikatana came out, so that kind of wiped the memory.
Oh my God!
People don't remember Daikatana very well either. Do
I remember Daikatana. They were selling it at Micro Center for $5, and they had like 50 copies or something. Darius went and bought half of them. He was like, "Oh my God, they're selling Daikatana! I bought 20 of them." So I'm probably exaggerating, but he bought more than one. So was that before? I don't remember the year exactly on that, but was that? I'm thinking that was before Deus Ex, right? So you did that, and then you went to.
That's right. I did pre-production on Clive Barker's Undying to kind of help the team transition to the next product. Okay. Then I left, and I kind of actually just dropped out of gaming for a while.
Okay, and then a while, like in a few years, or
I think about 2 years. I did contract stuff on Deus Ex for probably about the last 6 months of development.
What was the nature of that? Was it writing?
I did writing, and I did basically mission logic. Deus Ex is a great product, but it was a product that came together in the last 6 months or so of its life. I don't know if you guys messed around with this process or not, because I mean, Deus Ex had a lot of different elements in it, you know, and it was similar to Trespasser, and there was this crazy chimera of systems. There was a lot of work done in the last six months, making the missions make sense, making the gameplay coherent, which I didn't contribute that much to.
When you talk about contribution, going back to that idea of authorship, I guess, I mean, obviously a lot of people attribute Deus Ex to Warren Spector, and I guess what is your, since Deus Ex is sort of like this widely revered game as being sort of like, you know, has interesting things to say about the world and interesting game design and stuff like that, and everybody says it has great writing, like what is your sense as a collaborator on that, how that kind of breaks down in terms of like who was on it? Do you see like that game as a person, like does it really have a vision holder, or was it just like an interesting confluence of people?
Well, to break it down, I mean, the writing was mostly Sheldon Piccotti, who really kind of had that kind of the dark sort of conspiratorial future world voice. I think that is the characteristic Deus Ex voice. Obviously, as a game that allows you to have player agency and make the gameplay differently each time, and support choice. I mean, that's a Warren Spector hallmark, and you'll see it on everything that Warren works on. So you've got to associate that with him. Although Harvey Smith was the lead, was he the project lead or the lead designer or both?
Lead designer.
Both the Smiths worked on that game too, right? There's a Randy Smith also worked on it.
No, Randy was at Looking Glass.
Oh, at that time. Yeah. Oh, because he was working on Thief.
He was on Thief. Yeah.
He came down on Thief 3, 4, and Thief 2.
After that. So I mean, and yeah, given all that stuff to Harvey's done since, you have to see it as a Harvey Smith game as well.
Oh, that's interesting. So when you came in and were working on it, were you sort of like conscious of that voice and sort of trying to work inside of that? Did you like see what they had done and like, how can I make this work?
Or I was there late on the project. I was trying to support, Sheldon's vision for the writing. Chris Todd was also there, did a super great job. I worked on the mission logic some, which was really where we worked hard to support choice and different paths. I remember I worked a fair bit on the Hong Kong mission, which was just a maze, but in the end came out really well. I was vision support. I was not vision at all.
Is there how does that collaboration relate to some of this? So you also are credited on Deus Ex 2 and Thief 3 as well?
Yeah, but that was strictly dialogue writing.
Dialogue writing.
Yeah, and whatever. Since I was in the building, I ran my mouth on various subjects, but you could only call it writing.
How was your, I don't know how this fits with, what is your impression of sort of how Thief 3 was sort of, fit in terms of like how it was trying to combine some of the like Iron Storm style with like the Looking Glass style of
game? I actually didn't play Thief 3, so I actually don't know how it came out in the end. I did play Deus Ex 2 all the way. I'm a Deus Ex 2 fan. We are few but proud. I thought that was a super good game.
So that's interesting though, because a lot of people don't like Deus Ex 2. So what is your sort of defense of Deus Ex 2, right?
Well, there were some tech problems that I think everybody owns up to, where they changed engines, and so the level building was in a different style. There was, I think, a conscious decision to make smaller, denser levels, as a way of leveraging some of what worked and to try to kind of have a sort of crucible of more interactions between game elements, which I think probably went farther than it needed to, but was super, super fun. I mean, somewhat it's a fun environment to play in, even when it does doesn't quite capture the same feel as Deus Ex One, but like, dude, lighting a dude on fire and then he dies, and another guy comes to check out what happened, and that dude catches on fire. I mean, I can watch that all day. And it was really strong with those kinds of interactions. Not many of which were that funny, but it was a fun game to play and strategize around.
But that kind of emergent gameplay. You feel like Deus Ex 2 had things like that that the first game did not have.
Well, I think the smaller level size had the effect they wanted it to, which was giving rise to more interactions between game elements, objects, AIs, and so forth, because they were just corralled into a smaller space.
Yeah, you sort of forced those things to interact together in a smaller space.
And they saw it correctly. That was one of the really, really cool things about Deus Ex 1.
So, if I may ask clarification there, is that basically that allows the player to do things the designers hadn't thought of? Is the small level effect?
Yes. And just to take elements that can interoperate, like say, you know, player placeable minds, and like make it more likely for them
to actually get somebody,
or you know, blow up and hurl a physics object, you know, somewhere else in the level. Again, I'm theorizing intention at this point. I saw the smaller levels, and I think that's what they were thinking, and I certainly saw that effect.
But that's really interesting, though, too. So even somebody involved in the project, you have some kind of... It seems like there's a certain level of ambiguity as to how intentional those things were. So intentionality is really interesting when you talk about authorship, right? It's like you play a game, and it feels like the designer wanted something, but...
And I've heard Harvey talk about emergent gameplay. He gave a great talk with Randy, I think probably GDC 04, perhaps. And you know, hearing how he talked about emergence and seeing that game, I put that intention together.
Okay, just like knowing what you know of him and playing the game and stuff like that. Okay, was that and then afterwards and then most? What's your more recent stuff? I mean, on Tomb Raider Legend, I know you worked some on. Right?
Yeah, I worked on pre-production there. I don't think I've had anything come out and ship since then. I worked a whole bunch on a game codenamed LMNO at EA Los Angeles that did not ship. And then I worked some on Disney/Junction Point, Warren Spector's new Mickey game, which according to Wikipedia comes out in September. So that's not out yet. And I've been working on some pre-production stuff at Arcane Studios with Harvey. But
when you say working, you mean doing mostly, is it mostly writing? Is it like consultancy about design or both?
Writing and modeling narrative and modeling choice are the things I talk most about. Because the thing is, I have my writing career and academic stuff have come up. So I don't have the bandwidth for full-time game development anymore, which is sad.
Well, that sounds, when you talk about the modeling narrative and modeling choice, it sounds like that's kind of it sounds like you've developed sort of like a fairly coherent theory of sort of an aesthetic of like what you want out of that or direction you and other like-minded people want to push for in that in games, and that when you go to a new game project, it's like the idea is to let's try and enact this, let's try and push this forward.
Yeah, I wouldn't hardly say I had a theory of the subject, but I have managed to make probably more mistakes in that area than most other people have had a chance to. So that is what I bring to the subject. I don't mean to be facetious. I have thought a bunch about it, and I taught a class at Columbia where I managed to put together some lectures about it. So I have half coherent ideas about that.
Where do people just if people are interested? Is there any way they can have access to those that lecture information? Or
by no means. I don't believe that it's online. I mean, plus it's a bunch of PowerPoint that only makes sense if I'm talking, and even then.
What do you feel? What do you feel? I guess sort of. I mean, it feels like sort of like the through line seems like sort of talking about the early work and the early frustrations on game with sort of like normal narrative game conventions and stuff like Underworld and how that sort of grew and evolved over successive projects and successes and failures and stuff like that. And I'm wondering if do you have an idea of like what work you've worked on the most? Like, what is a game you worked on that you felt was sort of like the most interesting or the most rewarding in that way, or that got the closest, or?
well, I would have to say, System Shock. I mean, that was you know, the biggest jump in innovation. I think probably the biggest sort of most harmonious, you know, coming together of elements. There were some good ideas and fun writing in Trespasser, but obviously, as a whole, it doesn't quite come together the way it should have. But it, a game that I feel like I contributed substantially to that came together the best, it would have to be System Shock. Unfortunately, I mean, full-time game development is so grueling. Now that I've branched out, it really saddens me that I probably won't have the leisure, at least for a while, to sort of sit down and do a big product cycle where I get to try out more and more ideas. That is sad.
So it sounds like your sort of strategy for the past few years has been, there are people like Warren, people like Harvey, who are kind of like in the trenches doing the work full time.
And you can come in and be an outside eye, and also a lot of places don't want to hire a writer full time. So you can come in and kibitz, which is the fun thing to do. And it's good in some ways because you can come in and give your opinion and run out, but you don't have that kind of control, and you can't see a product from start to finish. But wow, I mean, the way games are developed right now is not very kind to writers. unfortunately, it's one of the reasons I'm out of it, which is that it's not creativity driven enough for me yet. It's certainly long hours for not that great compensation. It's not a writer or storyteller's medium to the degree I would need it to be to sink all that that energy into it anymore.
Was it ever? Was it that way, or did you just sort of make it work because it was fun? Or
I made it work because it was fun. I mean, it worked because it was fun. It was collaborative and such an incredibly exciting meeting. And if I had several of me, one of them would certainly be doing that full time. But you know, I went off into novel land, and in a way, whatever. It lets me, you know, push my vocation further and push writing more purely as a medium further. I have to say that writing for video games, it's a lot of fun, but like, you know, you're writing in a medium for which text is not the main show, the main strength of the medium. You want things to move on the screen. You want to parse space. You want to see systems interact. You know, that isn't really about text.
Even if the text is going to be like performed, right?
Like, I mean, it's awesome to have the text there, but it gives things flavor. It fills in the sensory picture. It gives us the story, but you're not really building a world out of text the way you are with a novel.
It's more like a play, perhaps?
A little bit like a play, but like, I mean, even less. I mean, games are so much about space. They're so much about calculation and looking at how a system goes. I mean, computers aren't super great at language. They can record it, play it back, but like, they're you know, that tangible sense of affecting and calculating about a system, that isn't really linked to text. I don't know if people talk about making games as authoring a system, which is a formulation that I believe in fairly strongly, and it's not the same thing that a writer does. So I feel like it's not the medium that privileges that strengthened me. So I feel like if I'm gonna give myself to something full time, I wish it were games, but at the moment it isn't. Maybe when there's a stabler platform for creative development, it would be something to come back to, but novels take a long time to write too.
Well, I mean, this was great. Thank you very much, and thanks to Drew and Sarah for being here as well.
Thank you very much.
Cool. It's always fun to talk about this stuff.